From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Justice Department appears to be seeking even greater powers in the hunt for terrorists than it got in the USA Patriot Act of 2001. New measures could include more wiretaps, secret searches, and secret detentions, plus broad DNA profiling, and that's just for starters. A confidential rough draft of what is being referred to as Patriot 2 has been leaked, and a growing range of opponents, from the ACLU to Gun Owners of America, is pushing back. Tonight on Point, Patriot 2, the bigger, beefier, more intrusive anti-terrorism act, and its impact on American liberties. We begin with a step-back look at how the original Patriot Act became law and a closer look at the man who led the administration effort to push it through, Attorney General John Ashcroft. For that, we turn to Stephen Brill, contributing editor at Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, After, How America Confronted the September 12th Era. I asked Stephen Brill what he knows about Patriot II and how its quiet emergence compares to the introduction of the first Patriot Act.
Well, Patriot I even emerged more stealthily. The Attorney General didn't consult the White House or even the Republicans in Congress and just sort of floated it out there and then announced it on the Sunday talk shows, much to the surprise of people in the White House and people in Congress. So this, at least whether it leaked or not, or came out as a trial balloon, at least we've had a lot more notice on this. In fact, when the Attorney General introduced Patriot Act 1, he talked about it on a Sunday and said, we need to pass this by Thursday.
There was, of course, at that time, all the national trauma of the immediate post-9/11 period to push this through. What about now? Do you think that opposition or at least more skepticism has grown in the U.S. Congress, or can John Ashcroft push through a Patriot II on anything like a similar timetable?
I don't think he can, but I think it, you know, obviously it depends on what's in it and what ends up in it. But I think he would have a lot more trouble because I think the Republicans in the House in particular are so upset about what's happened in terms of accountability over Patriot Act 1, where there's a scene in the book where the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee just explode over the answers they get when they send Ashcroft letters asking him for statistics and details on what happened with Patriot Act number 1, how many libraries were raided for reading materials, how many wiretaps were there, how many searches were there without telling people they were searched, all that stuff. And they never got any good information on that, so they're going to be loath to want to give him even more power.
So what does the attitude demonstrated by John Ashcroft in pushing through Patriot One tell us about what to expect now and about how the Attorney General may see his needs now and Congress's role or Congress's lack of role in John Ashcroft's vision in processing this?
In the discussions I had with Ashcroft, what became clear to me, clear because he actually said it, and in fact he said this to Congress, is he sees himself not as the typical attorney general, but as the general, the lead general in a war at home, much akin to Tommy Franks being the lead general in the war overseas. So that for Congress to question what he does, or for a judge to haul him into court and say, how come you're treating someone this way versus that way, to his mind, and you've seen some of this in some of their legal papers that they've submitted, is the same as a judge calling Tommy Franks in and saying, how come you tied that prisoner up that way, or how come you went up this pass and put these people in prison and didn't put these people in prison, and you held these people at gunpoint, you didn't hold these soldiers at gunpoint. He sees himself as a wartime general who's been delegated powers by the commander-in-chief, not so much as an attorney general who's an officer of the court.
But John Ashcroft is not Tommy Franks. Isn't part of his job to preserve civil liberties?
And he would tell you that he's been doing that. In fairness to him, he would tell you he's been doing that, but he'd also tell you that the president gave him a responsibility and a job that no attorney general's ever had before. The president, on the day, the afternoon of September 11th, takes him aside and says, John, make sure this never happens again. So an attorney general whose new job is to prevent crime, not prosecute crime, not find a criminal after a criminal act has been committed and present evidence in court under the rules of evidence and under the, you know, complying with the Fourth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment. That's not his job. His job is to stop these terrorists who are living among us quietly, who aren't committing any crimes until they act. His job, as he sees it, is to find them and stop them. And to his credit, so far, he's done a pretty good job of that.
there has been a leaked rough draft of what's being called roughly Patriot 2, this new act that would help the Justice Department or give them more authority in going after terrorists. John Ashcroft is on record saying that this doesn't exist. There's not a proposed Terrorist Act 2 from the Justice Department, he has said. What do you make of that?
Well, from the Justice Department, which is a draft, is not a bill that has been vetted by the Justice Department. That's the only thing I can make of it.
Where do you think this is all going to end up, Stephen Brill, given opposition in Congress, given civil liberty concerns, given concerns about terrorism?
I would be real surprised that, except with some modifications on some details and specifics where they found holes in the structure, I'd be real surprised if we ended up with a bill that broadly expands powers in any way like the first Patriot Act did.
And what about the sunset clause of the first Patriot Act? Do you expect that the sun will go down on
that
or
not? That sunset clause is not going to go away. That sunset clause is going to go away over Jim Sensenbrenner's dead body. He's the House conservative Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and that sunset clause, which was watered down already from what he wanted it to be, I'd be shocked if he allowed that to go away.
Stephen Brill, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Stephen Brill is author of the new book, After: How America Confronted the September 12th Era. He spoke with me from San Francisco. The first USA Patriot Act sailed through Congress after 9/11. Since then, federal agents have scrutinized the records of library patrons. Internet providers have handed over information about subscribers. An American citizen, Jose Padilla, is being held as an enemy combatant. And scores of immigrants are still in federal lockup. Now, Patriot 2 could extend the government's reach even deeper into the lives of American citizens. Does the government need an even freer hand in the war on terrorism? Where would you strike the balance between tough laws and individual rights? Are we giving away core liberties in the name of defending freedom? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Reston, Virginia, is Tim Lynch, director of the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice and author of a big think piece, Breaking the Vicious Cycle, Preserving Our Liberties While Fighting Terrorism. Good evening and welcome, Timothy Lynch.
Good evening. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Tim Lynch, take us in here. I think it would probably help a lot of listeners if you could lay out exactly what ground the first Patriot Act broke and whatever you know about where Patriot 2 would take us.
Well, one of the most disturbing things about the Patriot 1 law was the whole way in which it was enacted. I mean, there are good ways to pass laws and there are bad ways to pass laws. And I think the Patriot 1 law was a textbook example of how not to enact law. As you covered with Mr. Brill earlier, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, went to Congress with one of these big bills that's like the size of a telephone directory, mm-hmm. and he slopped it down and said, look, I want this passed inside of a week. And even supporters of the administration said, look, this is a large, complicated bill. That's just not going to happen. So he said, okay, well, let's pass it in 2 weeks. So there's this big rush on a large, complicated piece of legislation.
But it was at an extraordinary moment in American history. I mean, the World Trade Center had just come down. The Pentagon had been blown open. It's hardly surprising at one level that there was a rush to do something.
Of course, there was that imperative. I mean, there was a lot of fear that there would be additional attacks, and that's why some legislators said, well, look, this is a large bill that you are proposing. It's large, it's complicated. Let's break it down into some smaller parts because there are some things that are not controversial. There's some things that everybody agrees on. So let's break it down past those parts right away, slow it down, and let's have Congress take a closer look at some of these more controversial aspects.
But Ashcroft wanted the whole enchilada right away.
They wanted to keep it one big package, up or down on one thing. Let's call it the Patriot Act to intimidate anybody that's raising questions about it. And it was a very dangerous way, I think, to enact legislation. You mentioned the sunset provisions. Well, some people came along then and said, well, look, if we're going to have an up or down vote, if we're going to rush this thing into law, let's at least attach these sunset provisions, which would have the law expire after, say, 2 years. That way we could have a slow, calm, deliberative process as the law is being implemented, and we could take a look if these powers are being abused or if they're really necessary. And if the law has merit, then Congress can enact it again. But the administration and the Attorney General fiercely resisted these sunset provisions. We did end up getting some, but they were over the objections of the Bush administration. And now, even now, quietly, some senators are moving to remove those sunset provisions to make the Patriot Act permanent.
Tim Lynch, make this concrete for us, if you would. I mean, that's concrete in its own way. But what were the provisions that were the most aggressive, the most beyond tradition in giving new powers to the federal government, the Justice Department, to go after terrorists or, I suppose, whoever else fell in their scope under the Patriot Act?
Okay, let me give you some specific examples of how the checks and balances of our constitutional system have kind of been dismantled. One is the subpoena power that the government now has. They have the subpoena power to go and get information, medical information from doctors and from hospitals. They can get the educational records from high schools, colleges, and universities, and they can get these types of information from credit card bureaus and email surveillance, and they can do all of this without the judicial check that normally applies to when police agents want to get search warrants or arrest warrants.
This was new with Patriot One.
That's right. That's right. Once these agents go in, there's kind of like a facade of a judicial process, but they go in with an application and they basically say this is for a terrorism-related investigation. And then the way the Patriot Act reads is that, well, then the subpoena or court order shall issue. There's really no independent check by the judge saying, well, what, this looks like a fishing expedition to me. You know, what evidence have you gathered? That's what normally goes on with a search warrant or an arrest warrant. The judge says, no, you haven't got enough information
right
here. Do some more investigation.
So there's just one example. Is that necessary to fight terrorism? The country certainly was threatened and we're told remains threatened.
Well, the reason why I don't think it really is necessary, again, is because if you look at the process by which this was rammed through the Congress, if it was really necessary, then there would be enough support in the Congress to pass these things. But you see the Bush administration not wanting independent votes on these provisions. We will put it in one, stick these provisions into a telephone directory size law.
But it passed pretty overwhelmingly.
It passed overwhelmingly, but that was because sunset provisions were put in there, and a lot of senators, even though they had a lot of reservations about it, they did not want to be perceived as being, you know, soft on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why, you know, they labeled it a Patriot Act to try to intimidate anybody who is opposed to it. I think if the process had been slowed down a little bit, if it had been broken down into some smaller digestible pieces, then you would have seen more senators vote against some of these specific aspects. But this was a gigantic bill.
Jack Beatty, we're going to go into more of the details of what was in the Patriot Act, what may be in Patriot 2. But here we have this interesting situation where we've got Tim Lynch from the Cato Institute, a conservative institution, up in arms about the erosion of civil liberties in Patriot 1, let alone what may yet come.
Yes, and as I remember, Dick Armey, when he was in the Congress, was a stout critic of some of these policies. You know, a lot of this depends upon the person and the character of the person. And we know things about John Ashcroft. We know, for example, that he received fewer votes as an attorney general nominee than any candidate in history from the Judiciary Committee and the Congress. And that's because he lied to the Senate when he was a senator about a very important matter. And then we know something else. After September 11th, before the Judiciary Committee, he said, those who are criticizing the government are giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Now, that showed an authoritarian mindset that is completely at variance with the American tradition of liberty and shocked the senators at the time. And I'm afraid, just in things one has read since, seems to color a lot of what goes on in that Justice Department. For example, Jane Mayer in the New Yorker had a really scarifying piece about how they have fired a whistleblower from the Justice Department who tried to make justice live up to its requirements on searches. So And then sued her to shut her up. So this is a man we don't want, I don't seems to me, with these sorts of powers.
But more powers already in the federal government's hands. Maybe more to come. We're talking tonight about Patriot Act 2, the bigger, beefier anti-terror legislation and its potential impact on civil liberties. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Patriot 2, the bigger, beefier anti-terror legislation and its potential impact on civil liberties. You can join the conversation. Does the government need still more powers to go after potential terrorists? Are we giving away our civil liberties in the name of defending freedom? Do we need to? And what's the right balance of tougher laws and inviolable rights? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by our own Jack Beatty, by Tim Lynch. Joining us, he's the director of the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice and author of the piece, Breaking the Vicious Cycle, Preserving Our Liberties While Fighting Terrorism. And now from Washington by Orrin Kerr. He's professor at George Washington Law School. A new article of his, a recent article, Internet Surveillance After the USA Patriot Act, The Big Brother That Isn't, appears in the current issue of the Northwestern University Law Review. Good evening and welcome, Orrin Kerr.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Orrin Kerr, you have heard the concern about the erosion of civil liberties that the Patriot Act and successor acts may entail. What's your view? Are we giving away the shop of American liberties here in the name of fighting terrorism or not?
Well, we need to be careful here. I think actually a number of the views that people have are actually based on a misunderstanding of current law. I think actually the Patriot Act was much more modest than people feared it would be. So there was a great sense when 9/11 happens that major intrusions on civil liberties are about to occur. The government proposes an anti-terrorism law. People jump to the conclusion that this had to be a dramatic shift in civil liberties. And it turns out when you look through the details of the legislation that actually passed, it's a much more modest set of legislation than people fear it is. And let me go to an example.
All right.
Mr. Lynch gave the example of the new subpoena power that's been granted. And he said, well, it used to be you needed a search warrant to subpoena this information. Now you don't. Well, actually, it turns out that the traditional thing that happens in criminal cases is that there's no judicial review whatsoever, none. And in fact, any prosecutor can obtain a subpoena, even just to make sure no crime was being committed. And what the Patriot Act did is it said, this idea of a subpoena power, let's apply it to foreign intelligence cases. Let's apply it to spy terrorism cases. And what we'll do is we'll require the head of the FBI or someone who he delegates this authority to can approve a request. It then goes to a court, and a special federal judge has to approve the request for information that's analogous to this existing traditional criminal subpoena power. So it's a new authority in the sense that there was never this authority that the spy terrorist investigators had before. But it's actually pretty similar to a power that pretty much every prosecutor in the country has and has had for about 100 years.
And we'll come back and look at that with Tim Lynch, but your view of what is now being proposed. I mean, no one is sure exactly what's going to be put forward. It's been kind of quiet. We're reading things that have reportedly been leaked, but what we read is about new powers for secret arrests and detentions, about warrants that would issue the top secret foreign intelligence surveillance court warrants to include U.S. citizens, so not just foreigners anymore, but U.S. citizens would also fall into that, about a new DNA database that would create a DNA database of suspected terrorists to include people that the government says have associated with suspected terrorist groups. I don't know how much of that you can substantiate as being part of what may be requested, but those sound to a lay reader like pretty significant steps.
Well, I think you have to break them down. Some of them may be significant. Some of them may not be. So to take into one example, which I think is probably not a major change in existing law, there's a change in the proposal, or what may be the proposal for Patriot Act 2, to allow lone wolf FISA court orders. Now, what this means is that the government gets a court order from a judge that there's probable cause to believe that somebody is an agent of a foreign power. Basically,
this is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a rather unusual court itself.
That's exactly right. It's a court, actually, that was just invented in 1978. And its proceedings are secret, but there's a panel of normally confirmed federal judges who approve these requests. And they're tightly regulated but secret, so it's sort of a balance in terms of we don't get to see it, but it's internally regulated.
And now will this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court be used against American citizens as well?
The law has long allowed surveillance of American citizens. And what's interesting is that before 1978, there was broad authority even without any kind of warrant at all. So if you go back 50 years, this sort of surveillance was done by J. Edgar Hoover, just at J. Edgar Hoover's whim.
Though that's not exactly what we want to cite as glowing precedent, is it?
Absolutely right. And in fact, this FISA idea, the idea behind FISA, is to limit and regulate this surveillance. But it's never been so tightly regulated that, for example, the government can't get a court order, even if they have abundant proof that somebody's a terrorist. And the trick is finding the right balance.
Tim Lynch, weigh in here. We need you to stand up for the other view. Is this all just about tweaks and kind of a modest tightening up of old judicial powers, law enforcement powers, nothing to worry about?
Well, again, you have to go back to the fact that the Patriot Act is a large, gigantic piece of legislation. As I said, it's a small or medium-sized telephone directory. There are some parts of it that are not controversial, that are simply tweaking existing law. There are other parts of it that are very controversial, that do expand the power of the federal government greatly, and that is why the Attorney General and the Justice Department wanted it all to be in one giant package.
But get specific with us, because just we know that a very big bill can have little in it sometimes.
Well, one of the most controversial ones is one we've been reading about in the newspapers lately, is the librarians and owners of bookstores. They are not only can be served with subpoenas and court orders for information and their records of what customers are buying, what books are being taken out, but they cannot even speak on radio shows like this or tell reporters what the government is demanding of them. So this is a new gag order that raises basic free speech principles. This is one of the most controversial aspects of the Patriot Act.
And Tim Lynch, your bigger point, the point that you made not long ago, was you say that to quote you, the cycle of terrorist attack followed by government curtailment of civil liberties must be broken, or our society will eventually lose the key attribute that has made it great, freedom. Do you see that happening?
Yes, I do. I mean, what I'm very, very fearful of is not so much that the Patriot Act 2 proposal will pass in the next 3 months. My main concern is that at some point, America will be attacked again. And that is the point where the Justice Department and the people in the government come forward with these bills, and they say, okay, we've been attacked, here's another anti-terrorism bill, let's rush it into law to make everybody safe, and they exploit everybody's fear.
You say legislation doesn't make Americans safer.
Tom, if we keep redrawing this line between liberty and security, we're eventually, you know, 10, 15 years from now, going to end up throwing the freedoms away, you know, surrendering the very freedoms that have made America a great country.
Jack Beatty, how do you see it?
Well, you know, as I've been listening to this, I remember hearing a woman on C-SPAN the other day was asked about the Patriot Act, this library business, other things, and she said, I don't mind. They can look at my records. They can look at my – I've got nothing to hide. And I thought, now, what does that remind me of? And what it reminded me of was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian who was murdered because of his part, very tangential, in the assassination plot against Hitler. And he said a very profound thing that I think all of us need to keep in mind here. The target of many of these efforts are not, as you could, people by the name of Smith or Beatty. Mm. They're Muslim or Muslim Americans, and often even racially profiled. And what Bonhoeffer said was this. He said, and I may have the order wrong, he said, when they came for the communists, I didn't care because I was not a communist. When they came for the homosexuals, I didn't protest because I wasn't a homosexual. When they came for the socialists, I didn't protest because I wasn't a socialist. And when they came for the Jews, I didn't protest because I wasn't a Jew. But when they came for me, there was no one to protest for me. That's what happens in a society when you start down the slippery slope of these things, and when they are targeted to a minority group, as this is. People don't feel, well, it's not my liberties, and they don't ask themselves, well, what if these things were being done to me? Would I not see this as a tremendous erosion of my privacy and freedom?
We're talking about Patriot 2, son or daughter of the Patriot, USA Patriot Act tonight. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Ron's calling from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I very interesting conversation, and I thank you for taking my call. I agree. I think that we need to adjust and modify some of the shortcomings in Patriot 1. I think we have to get both parties, both sides of the issue discussed and out in the open, and I think it needs to be looked at very carefully and but agreed upon that there are going to be some hard decisions to make.
So it's going to be difficult. We should do it right. It's going to be hard. But what do you think of the general trend, Ron?
I think that we are becoming we're tending to lose some of our freedoms as we go down the line, as Mr. Beatty says. I agree with that. Nevertheless, I think that we have to look very, very carefully to make sure that we do have rules in force that allow us to maintain the freedoms in our country at the same time give us the ability to interdict problems before they arise, if possible, and not wait until we have another 9/11.
Got it, Ron. Thanks for your call. No one wants to see another 9/11 or in care. Tim Lynch makes the point. He asserts that these tightenings or increased government power that comes after the shock of a terrorist attack does not, in fact, significantly improve the government's capacity to go after terror. It simply whittles away at civil liberties without increasing that capacity. On the other hand, Stephen Brill points out at the top of the hour, we have not had another 9/11 since 9/11, and he seemed to be giving some credit to John Ashcroft for that. Is there room to tinker with civil liberties, to tighten up our defense against terrorism that does not erode those liberties?
I think absolutely. And in fact, I think a lot of the provisions in the Patriot Act are just that. As Tim Lynch conceded, many of the provisions, we're talking about 350 pages worth of legislation, many of the provisions, entirely uncontroversial. And in fact, when asked for another specific example of what was a new provision in the Patriot Act which was offensive, Mr. Lynch went back to the same provision he mentioned before, which is the Section 215, which is absolutely a controversial power. It's the same, as I said before.
Well, we don't really care if there are many uncontroversial. If there are only a few that are really corrosive to civil liberties, that seems serious enough in its own right, doesn't it?
Perhaps. And maybe the best solution is for the non-controversial provisions of the Patriot Act to stay and for the controversial provisions to be amended or tailored for as we move on into the future. That may be the best solution. I suspect, actually, that's what will happen. But it just turns out that the number of really controversial provisions is much lower than most people believe. And the kind of changes which could be made to, I think, address some of the civil liberties concerns are actually fairly minor changes to these provisions, not major ones.
Orrin Kerr, Tim Lynch, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Gail Shattuck. She's a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's joining us tonight from Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good evening and welcome, Gail Shattuck.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us. Gail, can you place us in this process? What's actually going on here? A draft of Patriot 2 was leaked a couple of months ago now. It seems now unclear where this thing stands, who's for it, who's against it, and even how it's being considered. Can you clarify that frame for us?
Well, the draft was leaked by the Center for Public Integrity. They published it on their website on February 7th. And you would think that by the middle of April, we would know something more about the status of that report. But I was speaking with the House Judiciary Committee just a few hours ago, and they still maintain that there is no draft for a Patriot 2. It has no status whatsoever. But it does have a great deal of political importance because there are, towns all over the country that are debating this new assault on their liberties. They're setting up. It was a really neat piece in the Washington Post today about a Bill of Rights Defense Committee and a town in California that outlawed implementing provisions of the Patriot Act in their town.
But why so quiet, Gail? I mean, shouldn't this is American civil liberties we're talking about and terrorism, both really, really serious matters. Why isn't this being discussed right on the floor of the Congress in the full light of day? Isn't that the way this ought to be done?
Well, if you remember the last election, there were people who lost their seats because they were on the wrong side of the national security question. And I think it's a very sensitive issue in the Congress. You'll have people talking about the importance of civil liberties and even raising interesting questions. Your viewers should take a look at the website for the House Judiciary Committee. There's a very interesting letter that Chairman Sensenbrenner and the ranking member, Conyers, sent to the Justice Department that raises 18 pages of questions. The most interesting one is the one I don't think we talk about enough, which is what authority under the Patriot Act, you know, passed in the white heat after 9/11, have you actually used to either prevent a plot or to, you know, convict a terrorist?
So they want to know if there's been efficacy, if these have been useful.
That's
provisions.
Right. Are you using them for anything? Now, a lot of the journalism around this, which I think has been quite constructive, is asking questions like, many of these things that the Justice Department asked for in the Patriot Act, they've been asking for years to use to prosecute other crimes. Are they just using these powers now to prosecute other crimes and not really go after terrorism?
You were sort of suggesting earlier that this was a national security issue, a hot potato for congressmen. They didn't even want to raise it. Maybe they're afraid to raise it. But, for example, you cite the House Judiciary Committee. Of course, the Republican chairman there is James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. He was very outspoken around the USA Patriot Act with his dissatisfaction about how all that came to pass. Is he quiet now?
No, I think I like the questions that he's raised, but I think you will not find a big push by the GOP leadership to bring this to the floor of the House or the Senate and to generate new legislation. They're talking only in terms of oversight, and frankly, in a wartime, this Congress has had very little to do. I don't think they'll have a lot to show for themselves at the end of 2 years. So
does that mean there won't be a Patriot II, that somehow it'll just be administratively addressed?
Oh, no. I actually expect that there is a Patriot II and that we'll see it. But I think what's interesting is that no one is yet acknowledging that it exists. That is, that draft that you can read, it has no status as yet. Neither the Justice Department nor anyone in Congress will say, ah, yes, that is the draft we're going to be looking at.
Owen Kerr, let me turn to you for just a moment. If this is just good and necessary tinkering, why not the open light of day? These are American liberties we're talking about.
Well, what we're talking about are ideas that are being considered within the Justice Department. So there are career people in the Justice Department, there are political people in the Justice Department, and typically bills are considered for 2 or 3 years before they are publicly introduced.
Typically, the last time it was a month, of course, it was after 9/11, but nevertheless, it was fast.
Oh, no, those bills actually, the language that was later became the Patriot Act, was actually something that had been under consideration in the Clinton administration for years. Mostly by career lawyers who were working in their areas of expertise. And then following 9/11, it seems that Ashcroft said, okay, we're going to try to pass legislation. Here are the areas that we need. What do the individual sections seem to have?
But, Gail, you're suggesting that this is not years away, that this could be on the floor of Congress soon.
Well, if this draft is valid, yes, I think it could. But I think that, you know, you're going to see it much more as a kind of symbolic issue than real legislation. I don't know that as real legislation it would pass or that they would even have the time for it. But you certainly are seeing a lot of organizing around this issue. The American Civil Liberties Union is mounting a new series of ads.
And at the other end of the political spectrum, we have the Cato Institute tonight. Gail Chadwick, I know we have to let you go, but thanks so much for cluing us in.
Thank you.
Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. We're talking about Patriot II, the bigger, beefier anti-terror legislation. You can join the conversation. Should we be going the other way? Should the first Patriot Act expire with its sunset provision? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Patriot Act II, the bigger, beefier anti-terror legislation that may follow USA Patriot Act that was passed in 2001 and its impact on civil liberties. You're welcome to join the conversation. There's been no terrorist attack since 9/11. Do you credit the Patriot Act with holding terrorists at bay? And how free a hand should the U.S. government have in fighting terrorism? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, our own news analyst Jack Beatty, Orrin Kerr, professor at George Washington Law School, and Tim Lynch, director of the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal justice. Tim Lynch, I wanted to turn to you with to ask about the process here. Gail Chadwick just reported to us the kind of murkiness that remains around the status and progress of preparation for the Patriot 2, as it's being called. Oren Kerr says, well, this is just standard procedure. A lot of long-term planning goes into legislation like this. It's not surprising that it's not all out in the open yet. How do you see the process that's going on?
Well, the only reason that we know about the Patriot 2 legislation is because it was leaked out of the government. Somebody in the government said, These provisions look a little scary. I think that the public, news journalists, media should become aware of this, and these provisions should be scrutinized before they are rushed through the Congress. So it's really only a matter of happenstance that we're learning and being able to study and scrutinize the provisions of Patriot 2 is because some conscientious public servant decided, well, look, I'm not going to let this thing go through the same way Patriot 1 went through, and so we leaked it, and that's why it's given us a chance to scrutinize these things before we are attacked again and these things are rushed into law. I mean, there were many congressmen, Tom, who were told that there was going to be a vote one day on Patriot 1, and they did not really have an opportunity to even read the legislation. As I said, it's a textbook example on not to enact law.
Tim Lynch, we don't expect the Cato Institute and the ACLU to line up shoulder to shoulder too often, but I have a quote here from Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, saying, "Our nation is poised on the brink of a dangerous new anti-civil liberties era." Is that too sweeping, or do you think that the ACLU head is correct?
I think they're largely correct. I mean, our civil liberties are definitely in jeopardy. I mean, we're talking about the governmental powers, the secretive subpoenas, secretive arrests, secretive searches, even talk of secretive trials. That was the military tribunal proposal. It wasn't part of the Patriot Act. But you have to look at all of these proposals that are coming out of the government, eavesdropping on attorney-client conversations, military tribunals, accusing, you mentioned the Padilla and Hamdi cases where you have American citizens being held in solitary confinement on military installations. That entails the right to counsel, you know, right to a jury trial, right to have habeas corpus, to have your day in court, to have an independent federal judge look at the legality of your arrest. So there's no question about it. Our civil liberties are under assault, and we've got to wake up and take a closer look about what's going on here.
And Oren Kerr, I want to get a better sense of the origins of your kind of coolness under apparent fire about this. Is it your view that these are all kind of just good housekeeping steps? These are administrative steps? You're a professor at George Washington Law School. Are you saying this just isn't important or that the magnitude of the terror threat justifies it? Can you fill that out a bit?
Absolutely. I'm not saying it's not important. To the contrary, these are issues we need to watch extremely carefully. What's fascinating so far, however, is that at least in the initial Patriot Act, the proposals that emerged, generally modifying pre-existing laws, were just much more moderate than we expected. When you look at the laws, when you look at what was proposed, the major steps that the government could have taken were not, at least in the initial Patriot Act.
Well, is that a measure by – I mean, they could have abolished habeas corpus. There's a lot of things they could have done, but is that really the measure by which we want to judge what they did?
No, I don't think so. But I think when you're looking at what the government was doing in response to clearly an enormous terrorist threat, taking into account are these steps reasonable – I think most of them, not all certainly, and I'm talking first specifically about the first Patriot Act, most of the steps within the bounds of the debate pre-Patriot Act. Now, what's more troubling
reasonable.
Is some of the
you seem so accommodating to these changes, Oren Kerr, to the minority, which may not be reasonable. I mean, perhaps that's right. Perhaps that's just being pragmatic. But you're teaching the law.
That's absolutely right. And I should say that when I was at the Justice Department, I worked on proposals to some of the criminal surveillance laws, and I was part of teams that were working on these laws along with many other career Justice Department lawyers. And so these are constantly evolving areas of law, and it's important not to lose sight of the context. Some steps are minor. Some steps may be more major, and maybe we should look at those. But I'm pretty confident that when you consider the possible civil libertarian objections, the dynamics on the Hill, that when all is said and done, actually the proposals that are passed end up being fairly moderate. And a good example is differences between the initial anti-terrorism law that the Justice Department proposed a week after 9/11 and the version of the Patriot Act that was passed into law. Although some critics will say, well, it only passed in 5 weeks. There was no time to even look at it. First, I would say, you know, more than a month is enough time to look at some legislation.
I don't know. We read about how Jim Sensenbrenner in Wisconsin got a hold of the first Patriot Act draft, sat on his porch in Wisconsin reading it, and was absolutely astounded at what he saw there, at being really at odds with fundamental liberties. It seems unnerving at some level that even comes up. I want to turn to the phones. Joe is calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking this call, and
sure.
Thank you for bringing this debate forward. It's so vitally important. And first, let me say that in agreement with Tim Lynch, civil liberties never disappear in a bang. They don't disappear with a magician waving his wand. They disappear incrementally, and that's precisely what Patriot 2 is to Patriot 1. And it's all a question of like waves eroding sand on the beach until eventually you look around and exactly as was brought forth before, you know, they take away this, they take away that, and then eventually there's nothing left to take away. And we cannot allow this to happen. This is perhaps the most critical aspect of the fight against terrorism, because it is never a tyrant working against a free people that disposes of its liberties. That requires a military victory, and that sort of scenario is not possible in the United States. There isn't a military power that's going to come over here and destroy us and take away our liberties. What is far more fretful to me and what is far more likely a scenario is that they will simply erode bit by bit over time. And once again, I must always resort to Franklin, because it seems as if we still haven't learned the lesson that if you try to buy your liberty with your security, you will end up with neither. And I don't understand why this isn't seen by more people, and I totally applaud Tim Lynch and the Cato Institute for what they're doing here.
Joe with Benjamin Franklin, I got to let you go. I want to get one more call in, but thanks so much for calling. Michael's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. During the period of debate about the act, I was struck by, on one hand, people from, speaking for it were talking about the new and very dangerous and implicitly temporary nature of the situation that demanded it, while on the other side,
the terror threat that was.
You know, other people in the administration were saying, oh, this is a war against terror that may last for generations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, in a sense, being sold as a momentary measure that that may just stick around forever. And I think it speaks to the corrupting effect of the metaphor of war on politics.
Absolutely, Michael. I appreciate your comment. We've got to let you go because our time's running down. But thank you for calling. Oren Kerr, what about the sunset provisions here? Do you think they'll be erased? Is the Patriot Act going to be with us in full forever?
I suspect what will happen is that in the next year or two, there will be some sort of compromise. Some of the most controversial provisions will be watered down. The uncontroversial provisions will stay.
There's a note of optimism in Tim Lynch. Are you equally optimistic?
No, I'm afraid I'm not. I mean, even now we're seeing moves in the Congress to quietly remove the sunset provisions on the Patriot Act to make those changes permanent. And then my fear with Patriot 2, again, is not so much that it will be enacted into law in the next couple of months. I'm afraid, though, that maybe a year from now, maybe 2 years from now, America will be attacked again, and the Attorney General, whoever he is, will come forward with Patriot 2 legislation.
And there will be all ready to go. Tim Lynch, Oren Kerr, thank you both so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tim Lynch is director of the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice, and Oren Kerr is a professor at George Washington Law School. Jack Beatty, there's a scenario described by Tim Lynch that's easy to imagine. I wonder if the administration will wait, though, for another attack to push this forward.
Well, it's a fearful prospect in any case. But, you know, look at their priorities. They're willing to go toward this stuff on civil liberties, but to interfere in the economic freedom of our corporations by asking them, requiring them to pay for more security? No.
And so we still have big chemical plants vulnerable to attack.
No. You know, lobbying from the chemical industry, we're not going to put up money. There was some lobbying from the maritime industry. They were going to have a tax that would raise $700 million a year to pay for security. Lobbying killed that. So what's going to defend us? Are these, you know, looking at librarians, the books people take out of the library, or security at our ports paid for by the corporations?
It says something about priorities. That's true. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org in a moment. A tribute to American soldiers not serving in Iraq. This is On Point. Massachusetts resident Pam Mealy understands the difficulties facing American soldiers stationed far from their families. Her husband, Coast Guard reservist Todd Mealy, has been deployed for the past 3 months, not in Iraq, but in Wilmington, North Carolina. Pam Mealy says she is frustrated that the sacrifices her husband and family are making are not getting the respect they deserve.
There's nothing glamorous happening in North Carolina, where my husband and a couple hundred other soldiers have been deployed. But still, they are there, standing watch, serving their country, missing their families. It hurts a little when people ask if I know when my husband will ship out. A chief petty officer in the United States Coast Guard Reserve, Todd was notified in January that he had 72 hours to get his sea bag ready and report to Wilmington, North Carolina. Our two children, 4-year-old Samantha and 2-year-old Dawn, are starting to wonder why Daddy's job is taking so long. We are a two-parent team. After I hoarded our first baby, he declared the second would be his, and 2 years later, she still is. Since her first day home from the hospital, Todd held Dawn constantly. Before tucking her into the crib each night, he would feed her a bottle in the rocking chair while reading her favorite books, then rub her back until she fell asleep. Now she refuses to sleep in her crib and keens hauntingly for Daddy in the middle of the night. The only person in our household who seems to be handling the separation remotely well is our 4-year-old daughter. She's mostly concerned that Daddy won't be home for her 5th birthday. I hope she's wrong, but if he is still down there, we may have to take her birthday to him. Yesterday was Easter, and it was bittersweet. When we dated, we always insisted that Easter was our special holiday. I would make small baskets, and we would drive into Boston. We'd find a gathering of homeless people and hand out the Easter baskets. It was our secret. Then we'd go for brunch and spend the afternoon walking along the waterfront. We dated for 7 years before marrying in 1993. The longest separation we've ever had was back in the late 80s, when he spent 3 weeks in Coast Guard Leadership School in Washington. 3 months ago, we took the girls skiing for the first time. 3 months ago, we talked about finally shingling the garage. 3 months ago, we had an argument about finishing our upstairs. Then he was deployed, and our daily life was replaced with the chaos of trying to finish up at work, pick up the kids, and get dinner started without his help. Bathing the girls, reading to them, and getting them into their beds became even more important so that I could call him each night at 9 p.m. I find myself growing anxious and frustrated when the girls won't go to bed on time. The newspaper where I work has begun writing profiles on local soldiers who are fighting the war on terrorism. I thought of Todd's roommate, a teacher who left behind a wife and 2 kids the same day Todd left me. I forwarded his name and cell phone number to a reporter doing profiles of activated soldiers. Her response surprised me. She said that the editors didn't want to interview the soldiers who were still stateside. "Just the ones in Iraq, but let me know when he goes," she explained. A few weeks later, however, she did write the profile. "I know the soldiers in Iraq are in an infinitely more dangerous place than the ones in North Carolina, or New York City Harbor, or California, but make no mistake, the ones in the U.S. are deployed. They are not still waiting to go over. They are gone from their families. It was hard for my husband and others with him to watch CNN and not feel guilty for being where they are. They feel helpless and even useless. My husband heard a lot of complaints from his crews. Some of them asked why they were even there. He told them what he told me. Someone has to mind the store." No, nothing glamorous is happening in North Carolina, but my husband is serving his country nonetheless. And so are we, his family.
Pam Mealy lives in Scituate, Massachusetts. Her husband, Todd, is a chief petty officer in the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve, now deployed in Wilmington, North Carolina. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.